and welcome to KBOO's holiday membership drive. And I am Sam Bowman. I'm joined in the studio by Jasmine Moneymaker and several other people. This is a forum on the state of police accountability and reform in Portland, Oregon, and in Oregon at large, and probably in the nation. And we are joined in the studio right now by Teresa Rayford of Don't Shoot Portland, by Kalei and Ted Leuben, activists and educators, active in the community for a long time, and by Maria Hammer of Pacific Northwest Family Circle, and we may or may not be joined by Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch coming up later this hour. I'd like to start by going around the table and asking each of you what to give us a little introduction to yourselves and what prompted you to become activists for police reform, or what got you involved in this work. And I guess we'll start to my right with Kalei and Ted.
Good afternoon, everybody. I started out with a course on racism, and part of what we were required to do for having received that course on racism was to do something about it after the course was over. So that I made a promise. This was at First Unitarian Church. I made a promise that I would spend 1 year in working on issues involving racism. And at that time, this was in the year 2010, at that time the really big issue was that police were shooting black people. And that didn't sit well with any of us, so that was the beginning of it.
All right, and Ted?
I'm Ted Leuben. I'm a retired civil engineer. As a civil engineer, I worked for the federal government, Corps of Engineers, for 20 years. Worked for the City of Portland for 15 years. Worked for other companies, engineering companies, and in between those two. And how we actually got to be activists, if you will, is we spent 2 years in Saudi Arabia back in the 78 to 80. And when we came back to the States, we found that nobody really was working on a peace effort between the Israelis and the Palestinians. So we took up that work for almost 30 years and ended up here in Portland again with, as Kalei just said, working on a police reform.
All right, and let's move over to Teresa Rayford. How are you doing today?
I'm doing all right, and I guess I got I thought about, let's say, I'm not really into police reform. I'm really more of a political activist, and I'm not looking for more training for these officers or these bureaus or these organizations. I'm looking for a real serious political change in regards to the way that they practice, in the way that they regard community safety, and in the way that their directives align them up with any type of criminal activity. It seems that, you know, we talk about police states, and for the entire time that I've been, you know, alive in the city of Portland, I was born here. So, you know, I grew up in Portland black as a woman. My family was active in city and local civil rights. You know, back in 81, the Portland police dropped dead possums off at my grandmother's restaurant in retaliation to the, you know, just the prosperity of a black business in a black community at the time. And it was racially motivated. It was a thing that I grew up dealing with. So I've never had in my mind the framework of a safe community policing model or a safe relationship with police. And so in my thought, I don't think that they need to be in our communities. I'm down with people like Critical Resistance that are looking for legal ways to abolish their relationship in communities. I don't support officers in schools. I don't support, you know, any of the policing type of models that we have right now. Right now in Oregon, we're dealing with the Department of Justice settlement that was put in place because of the death of James Chastity. We know that our police kill our most vulnerable community members. We know that domestic violence survivors are usually subject to police violence and sexual misconduct by officers. So just as a black woman in America, I've never seen much of a safe use for them. And so I think my whole activation or political resistance to them is based on my humanity and just my life experience. And so until I die, I'm going to be looking for ways to have a safe environment where my children can grow up and not have to be humiliated by state violence. And so becoming an activist was never a choice. It was a matter of fact.
Great. And Maria Hammer, you are... I don't remember exactly. Are you representing Pacific Northwest Family Circle, or
we can say that? Okay. But yeah, yeah.
And could you tell us a little about yourself?
Sure. My name's Maria Hammer, and I am from Salem, Oregon. And I am very green, and you know, but do have a passion for activism, and I always have. And I'm representing my brother, if anything, Chase Hammer. He was killed October 21st of 2012 by Officer Ryan Demmer in Salem, Oregon. And his story really hasn't been told. My family settled with the city of Salem in September of 2016. It's been a very long and emotional journey for our family. And, you know, with advice from our legal team at that point in time, during the process, we weren't really allowed to speak or do much. But now I've had, you know, almost a good year or so to kind of process a settlement and process the time without my brother. And so I am, you know, just very, very, you know, fresh into this, but very passionate behind it to find my voice. I kind of had an epiphany one day that I've always been the one to kind of speak up and say things for the people that can't say things, and been that, you know, the little girl on the school bus that would, you know, say, hey, that's not right, or I don't believe that you should treat that somebody in that way. I never thought in a million years that I would be speaking for my brother. That was kind of my epiphany. And we all wonder what we're doing here, wonder why I'm here. Well, you know, as much as I want my brother by my side, I guess I'm going to be carrying on his legacy in this way and in some capacity. I'm still really trying to find my voice and what my platform is going to be. You know, but he, his component to part of his shooting was mental health. And so that's definitely an addiction. It's definitely something I'm very passionate about.
Yeah, and it's easy to lose in all the policy discussion and the just the iconic nature of some of the names of these cases, that that these are incidents that affect people, and that it's, you know, before and after.
Mm-hmm.
And
most definitely.
And so I would actually, if you're able to share your mic with, we're joined also by Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch. How you doing, Dan?
Just fine, thank you.
If we're just going around, if you could introduce yourself briefly and tell us a little bit about how you got into the work that you're doing.
I'm actually a peace activist, and when we started protesting against the Gulf War in 1991 in the city, I was involved with that and watched over the course of the following year the police start cracking down on protests. The police shot a young 12-year-old boy who was taken hostage in his home in Laurelhurst neighborhood early the next year, Nathan Thomas, and people were like, why don't we have a stronger police oversight board? And then the uprisings happened in LA that April when the officers were acquitted for the beating of Rodney King, and we started our own peace group that is now called Peace and Justice Works, and said, what's going to be the local military action that we are going to oppose here? And the police was the area focus we decided to work on, so that's how we started Portland Cop Watch.
This is Jasmine. Dan, it's interesting that you mentioned Nathan Thomas's case. He was in my class. I was in the sixth grade when that happened, and it definitely had a big impact on our school, and I think it has shaped the way that a lot of people think about Portland and policing in Portland. So again, I want to thank everybody for being here. We've got a wide range of voices here and decades of experience working at changing the way that policing happens in our communities, from removing policing altogether to making sure that they have oversight, to really focusing on police and community relations. We're going to go to a break here in a minute, but we would love to hear from you, our listeners, about your questions. In the first half of this show, for the first hour, what we're going to be talking about is how we got here. Basically, from the early days of Portland to the DOJ settlement in 2012. And if you're not sure what the DOJ settlement was, then we're going to do our best to explain it for you and make that accessible. Following that, we're going to be talking about basically from 2012 to now, 5 years later. Has anything changed? Have improvements been made? Are we in any better place? And if not, what can we do? How can we all get active? And how can we make changes that keep the people in our communities safe? If you would like to contribute to this conversation, you can find us on Twitter at KBooNews. You can find us with the same @ on Facebook. You can send us an email to pmnews@kboo.org, and we will look forward to hearing from you and discussing your concerns with our guests. So thank you again, everyone, Kelly, Ted, Teresa, Maria, Dan, and Sam for being here. And we're going to go to our pitchers.
And we're back in beautiful Studio 2 here at KBOO, and we are joined by several people, and we are discussing the ongoing state of police either reform or activism against the presence of police in people's neighborhoods and lives, and the violence that is done by police to communities and community members. And I guess we're going to start looking historically at the role of the PPB, the Portland Police Bureau, in the reaction of communities over the years against their actions. And I guess, Teresa Rayford, you mentioned that you grew up in Portland, and correct me if I'm wrong, but your family has been here since the late 1800s, I
believe. Oh, yeah. My great-grandmother was born here in McMahonville.
Oh. All right. And in the 80s, there were several events. A few of them, you mentioned the possum incident at Burger Barn. How did you feel the community's distress at these events as a young person?
I mean, it was directly related to my family. I just got access to some VHS from back then, and so I was able to look at old footage of my grandfather and my dad during interviews. I was able to look at old interviews of Vic Atiyah and Mark Hatfield, the police chief at the time, the union president. I got to see Commissioner Jordan, and just the rhetoric, the way that people were dealing with it, being able to see those long extended interviews, because they weren't just looking for the sound bites back then. Back in those days, they would let people finish the whole conversation. They'd be in the back of the union hall while they were doing this illegal rigging of this illegal vote and capturing all of it on film. And so just for me to be able to look at where I am, 36 odd years later, dealing with the same, departments, the union, which now it's Daryl Turner, the commissioner, which is right now it's the mayor, but back then it was Charles Jordan, and he wasn't the mayor, so there has been a position in place where the city commissioners could actually have that seat so that you can reconcile different things with the mayor. And what I saw then was that the city, people from my community, were able to make an effort to speak directly to the commissioner and to the mayor in a way that would build some type of response that would entitle them to have oversight, which would entitle them to have some type of commitment from the city bureaus to create some type of accountability or oversight. And now we're just seeing that as resistance. I mean, we're looking at 36 years of that being a part of the positioning of that. Let's say that the possum incident and then the death of Tony Stevenson and then several incidents between then. When the possum incident didn't happen, I'm looking at news footage that I have on VHS, and they're saying that there were over 500 complaints. That incident happened like March 12th or 13th. So for the police to have so many harassment and intimidation and assault complaints and theft complaints against them coming directly from this community of color that I grew up in, I mean, nothing has changed. The only thing that I see is the repositioning of power. There's a lot of appointed leadership that is siding with the police, and they're asking for a policing partnership in our communities. They're looking to establish a relationship with the same system that has never been held accountable for the harassment and intimidation and just straight up white supremacist racist behavior against us. And that's the part that's not making me feel accommodating a reform system would make any sense. How do you reform a system that has just, you know, berated you during your entire existence? People are just now saying that they're seeing white supremacy and racism in our policing force because of Donald Trump. But if we have him as a president, isn't that a reflection of our values?
And could you briefly describe for our listeners what the Opossum incident was, if you don't
well,
mind?
Well, Dan might have more information than I do from what I know about I got from my dad and, you know, the family. And basically, my grandmother had a 24-hour soul food restaurant. It was right next door to an after hours, which my grandfather operated. And so people would come to Portland from all over the country because, you know, we have a trucking industry, we have a shipping industry, and we had a vibrant Black community at the time. And they would basically come there for food and to hang out and to, you know, to party next door or whatever, but they would buy food from my grandmother's restaurant. And for whatever reason, and they called it a prank in the record, two officers, but from the phone call, there were seven officers, seven cars that showed up, lots of officers, lots of activity, but the two officers who hadn't been written up that year were the ones that were named in the reports, and so basically thrown under the bus. So when they were fired for this prank, and the prank was basically they shot some possums and dropped them on the steps of the restaurant at the front door. So anyone trying to come out, there's these big, giant, dead possums that were shot by the police officers and brought to the premises in the back of the police cars, the patrol cars. My dad called Commissioner Jordan, let him know that this had happened, and by the time they made it downtown to the police station, he was able to just look in the cars, and there was the evidence, which was basically the bloody mats in the back, and there was an outcry and some outrage. But as in regards to any policy change, what I looked at in the city archives is there, but what I have on video is way more extensive than the information that's been documented in regards to it. In the city archives, there were so many letters that were sent to the commission in regards to the commissioner's response to this by firing the officers who were later acquitted and rehired. The response was, you know, they were upset about the possums being shot, you know, and there was this issue about the ordinance of killing animals within the city limits. My family, my grandmother was from Mississippi. My grandfather was from St. Louis. From where they're from, dead animals, dead rodents, possums especially, that's a threat to your mm-hmm. life. That's a death threat. But, you know, in the city of Portland, I have documentation where our governor and, you know, all these people were saying, well, that's not really what we were talking about when we were talking about anti-racism or hate or equity or any of those things. They did not regard our lives or safety at all.
And Dan, did you have anything to add to that about the policy fallout?
I think that around the same time there were shootings of a number of young Black men, and it led to the formation of our first police review system. I don't know, call it a police review board because we've never really had one here, but it was called PIAC, and essentially PIAC was the Police Internal Investigations Auditing Committee, and it was the city council. I won't bore you with the details. It was the city council, and they had citizen advisors who heard appeals of police misconduct cases, and then if the person didn't like the outcome from the citizen advisory board, they can go to the city council for an appeal. And that system was voted into place by a very narrow margin after the police union outspent the public 10-1. It was by like 0.1 percentage point that it won on the ballot, and it was forced on the ballot by the police association.
Sorry, I'm going to jump in. This is Jasmine again. So you have sort of talked about the fact that this, you know, now this isn't the first time that we've made efforts at community oversight and accountability arms that are seeking to change this pattern of police officers with the Portland Police Bureau who do these horrible things being not facing any punishment, basically not facing any consequences. Sometimes they are fired, or initially they face some punishment, but eventually with the strength of the union, it goes to an independent arbitrator, and they wind up back in the mix. I'm wondering, Kelly, can you speak a little bit to how these patterns of racist policing and no accountability led to the DOJ settlement or the DOJ investigation in 2010?
This is really an interesting conversation, because I was just reading about this possum incident. It's written up in one of the best articles that I've ever read, published in the Oregon Historical Society. It's an article called Black and Blue. Mm-hmm. And I happen to have seen some of that footage that you're talking about, Teresa, where a police officer is just lounging around in a chair, laughing his head off, saying, "Oh, I just did this to relieve stress." Whose stress was being relieved by dead possums thrown at a restaurant doorstep? Well, as Dan was talking about the Portland Police Association having spent an incredible amount of money, one of the things that's being pointed out is that the Portland Police Association bears a lot of responsibility for the lack of reform that has been going on decade after decade after decade. But back to the point of how did we get into the settlement agreement, when I decided that I would look into racism in Portland, I noticed that people were being shot by the police, and by the time 2010 ended, the thing I actually noticed was that every single person was a vulnerable person in crisis at the time of the shooting. When January came around, and I believe Teresa has family members that were involved in another shooting incident that took place January 2011, but my publication was called Shooting the Sick. After I did all of that research, that's pretty scholarly kinds of research, I turned it over to the city. The first person who got it was an assistant chief by the name of Chief O'Day, who's no longer with us, but I also turned it over to the auditor and to city council. And my question at that time was, do they not know they're doing this, or do they not care? And I see heads in the room shaking, and the question remains out there. Do they not know? Do they not care? So after giving the city a chance to do something about it, I then turned over my research to the United States Department of Justice. At the same time, the AMA Coalition was asking them to do an audit of uses of force, patterns and practices, and that's pretty much, I think, how the USDOJ entered.
Mm-hmm.
And so thank you, Kalei, for that. We're going to come back in 5 or 6 minutes. Right now, we're going to go over to the Pledge Drive headquarters again.
This is Jasmine. I'm here with Sam, and we're back in our conversation about the state of policing in Portland and what we as members of the community can do to change things. We have one question in here, which we're going to get to in a second, but I would like to remind everybody, all of our listeners out there, if you have something to add to this conversation, don't be afraid. Tweet or find us on Facebook at KBOO News. You can send us an email at kboonews@gmail.com. Kelly, before the break, you used an acronym, which is the AMA. Can you tell us what the AMA is and what they've been doing?
The Albina Ministerial Alliance began in the 1960s with the civil rights movement, and they've been going pretty much nonstop. At the time of the Kendra James shooting, a branch came off of that basic tree, and that's the AMA, Albina Ministerial Alliance Coalition for Justice and Police Reform. I work intimately with Dr. Bethel and Dr. Haynes and the steering committee, of which Dan Handelman is a member. So there are a number of people as part of this Coalition for Justice and Police Reform. Right now, that organization has been recognized in the settlement agreement as the enhanced amicus curiae, the friend of the court. And right now, they represent the voice of the community. I have to say that a sad, if not potentially tragic, thing happened earlier this year when a piece of the settlement agreement was just dismantled. The mayor, Ted Wheeler, disbanded the what we fondly refer to as the COAB, the Community Oversight Advisory Board. And so there really is no community voice going on in the settlement agreement right now.
If we can back up for a second, Dan, I'm going to ask you about this. When we refer to the settlement agreement, we're talking about in 2010, the U.S. Department of Justice, the Civil Rights Division, began investigating the city of Portland because of the actions of the Portland Police Bureau. You can correct me if I'm wrong on any of that, I'm sure. And then in 2012, they released their findings and entered into a settlement agreement with the city of Portland. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, well, just technically what they did the first year was they sought to see whether the death of Aaron Campbell was a violation of civil rights, and they found no wrongdoing there. And then they instigated the pattern and practice investigation the year after that. But yes, then they published the findings in 2012 and said there was a pattern and practice of excessive force, particularly against people with or perceived to be in mental health crisis. They refused, even though the data we gave them came from the Portland Police, to recognize a pattern and practice of excessive force against people of color in the city. And that has been a point of contention from the moment they threw their findings on the table. However, there are a couple places that the 170-some-odd paragraphs of the settlement agreement mention race, and so it is not out of the purview of people who are trying to make the reforms that are outlined in that document to talk about race issues. So that's generally, yes, what you said is more or less accurate. It took a while for the agreement to actually go into place because there had to be an agreement among the parties about what it was going to look like going forward. And that took a while because the city filed the lawsuit and they filed an appeal about one part of the judge's order, and things just took a long time to get going. But eventually, the police voluntarily entered into this because other cities where the DOJ comes in and finds these patterns and practices, they put what's called a consent decree in place, where a judge says you have to do this, and they are ordered to do things. The city decided instead that they would make an agreement that they would follow these rules and then just have report to a judge with the DOJ overseeing the changes that are being made.
So the settlement agreement's pretty complicated, and there's obviously a lot of legalese involved in it. But some of the most hopeful, I guess, is maybe an optimistic word by definition and in the way that I'm using it. Some of the most hopeful elements of the settlement agreement were that the Portland police needed to change their policies around use of force, that they needed to change the way that they responded to cases of people who were in active mental health crisis. And another big one, which is what Calais was mentioning earlier, was that they needed to bring more civilian oversight into the equation, into the accountability equation. And that was with the COAB, or COAB, which is now, after, what, a year or two of activity, 2 years of activity, it's totally defunct. Would one of you like to speak a little bit about the COAB and what happened there?
Oh, I will. I never really intended to babysit the settlement agreement because reform is so needed in the state of Oregon. I really thought that I could leave the city of Portland in the great hands of the United States Department of Justice, and they would solve the problem for all of us. But that proved to be erroneous almost as soon as I thought the thought. It turned out to be wrong. So I began going, and Ted went with me to every single meeting of the COAB, and including the subcommittees as well. And the stress and the tension to which these community members were submitted from the very beginning was absolutely a boding of, or a foreboding of, things going badly right from the very beginning. As a matter of fact, a couple of the members of the COAB said that they believed that the COAB was designed to fail. Mm-hmm. And when I talked with some of the members of the DOJ, that is the U.S. DOJ, they said, well, everybody knew things were not well defined, and so it was predictable that it would fail. I can't even begin to tell the audience how angry it makes me feel that because we don't have a union, apparently, therefore we can't have governance or a government that will deal straight, fair, plain, honest, open, democratic with us. We pay taxes. We support all of this. So it breaks my heart when I hear that we put in place a mechanism that would fail. Mm. And sure enough, the prediction came true. It failed. We are out. But KBOO's here, mm-hmm. and some of the rest of us are still here.
Yeah, and I wanted to, I wanted to piggyback on what Kalei said, because when the COAB was in its infancy, when it was being formulated, and the commissioners were given the charge of connecting with community members and asking them to apply for the opportunities, and even having the opportunity to nominate people, at that time, Don't Shoot Portland was doing a lot of protests, and we had been advised by the union president, President Darrell Turner, that the only way to win the voice of the protest, the way to get access to engagement and accountability, was to be present in the relationship of collective bargaining. And so in seeking what that relationship would look like, we got in contact with our commissioners, and I believe that it was Amy Ruiz in Amanda Fritz's office at the time who extended the application date for the COAB, which is the Community Oversight and Accountability Board, so that we, the community, would be put with the charge of marketing this to the community. And so we did an extensive campaign amongst not only the activist community, but just the community at large, to get people to apply for an opportunity to be on the COAB with our own resources and those of other communities that were affected by what we thought was going to be an outcome, like Kalei said, a failure. But we needed witness. We needed community input, and we needed community engagement to sit at the table and to be a part of that witnessing. And during the time that this was happening, what looked to be a partnership, which looked to be something that was promising to us as activists, working with the mayor's office, working with the city bureaus, building that opportunity to have two additional weeks, even doing Portland community media town halls with commissioner staff on the record, speaking to an audience that they had never connected to in regards to the importance of this and what it meant, holding a 4.5-hour dialogue at our church with the union president, the mayor, our community at large, so that people could ask questions and get the information right there, even from Judge Domenis, who was one of the liaisons that we were looking forward to working as the COCO at that point. A lot of work from the community being committed to watching the process happen with the knowing that it was going to be a failure. I discussed earlier that I hang out in the city archives, and every bureau or board that has been commissioned by the city in regards to enforcing community directives for safety or to have oversight has always led to failure. They always pick people specifically that have power or a voice in the community, and then the way that these things are structured structured, there's no foundational sustainable power. The people that are looking forward to this relationship from the community are looking to a leader that they trust, and that person's directive is to lose that trust because they become another barrier for any kind of resource. So even people that came from our community that selected to sit on there had to resign because it was too much. Even us wanting to continue engagement, we saw that it was just another barrier that was put there to basically discredit community in my behalf, in my, you know, opinion. Sorry, Ted.
Oh, go ahead.
There's something here that to me is key to all of this, and that is that we talk about a settlement agreement, which is an agreement between the City of Portland and the Department of Justice, in other words, the federal government. And this is overseen by a federal court, a federal judge. Now, what actually happened was the Department of Justice wrote a finding of their investigation of this whole situation. And then they sent a letter to the city saying that these are the things that are wrong and you need to fix them. And so the next thing that happened was, since they didn't get a response directly from the city in prompt fashion, the DOJ filed a federal lawsuit to get the city to comply. So the city finally responded to that federal lawsuit by crafting this settlement agreement. However, the settlement agreement does not admit any fault on the part of the city. So we're overburdened, and all this is overshadowed by the fact the city does not think they're guilty of anything. And that's the way they act. Mm-hmm. Teresa just mentioned how some of these activities affect all kinds of things in this city. Now, it continues to this day. The city has not admitted fault. They filed countersuits, if you will, in the Ninth Federal Circuit against the judge. The judge is prejudiced, et cetera, et cetera. The city has drugged their feet. They have delayed. I will say for sure, they made sure that the COAB failed. The city did that. Not the COAB people, not the people, mm-hmm. the citizens that were serving, but the city did that. And they did that on purpose. Now, the mayor has abolished the COAB and has come up with a new plan with the, I forget what it is. PSEP, which is a all-mayor-selected group of people that's to meet in secret marketing and advise the city and the police bureau on what they're supposed to be doing. We've gone through this whole gamut of being exposed to the community, and now the community's locked out. There's no avenue that the city, that the citizens can express their views to the city, except through the mayor's office. And we know how that goes. I'm not saying that the mayor's against any of this. He promised us that he would fulfill the settlement agreement. I was there at a meeting where he admitted he would do that, but he hasn't done it. And it's a year into his term, and he still hasn't done it. And we're not making any progress. Frankly, we're losing ground. Yes.
Thank you, Ted, for that. And before we go back to the pictures, I just want to point out that PSEP, that stands for Portland Commission on Community Engaged Policing, I believe. Right. So while we're... while we're listening to the pitch break in just a moment, you can just switch those words, community engaged, around in your mouth and see how they taste. All right, and we're back here in KBOO Portland Studios, and we are speaking again. I'll give everybody's name now that we're at the top of another hour here. We have Calais and Ted Lubin, the longtime community educators and activists. We have Teresa Rayford with Don't Shoot Portland and many other Endeavors, and Maria Hammer from Pacific Northwest Family Circle, and Dan Handelman from Portland Cop Watch. Thank you, everybody, again for being here. We got an hour left. Hope everybody is enjoying the discussion. Again, if you have questions or comments, you can get at us at at KBOO News on Twitter and at KBOO News on Facebook, or PMNews@KBOO.org. And so I would like to bring it back to 2010 and the years following that. In 2012, the DOJ investigation wrapped up into excessive use of force against people with mental illness in, or who were experiencing mental health crisis in Portland and Multnomah County. And in 2014, that we entered into a formal agreement with the city to implement or look like they're implementing some of the recommendations of that investigation. But one thing that we can say for sure that has not changed in those years is that shootings of people by police have not gone up or down, really, an average. And certainly the disciplining of police officers has not changed in the least, if not gotten worse. For example, the shooting of Aaron Campbell in 2010, Ron Frashauer has been, the saga over his reinstatement has gone on for years. He's currently still employed. But we'd like to go to Maria Hammer now. Maria, you traveled up here from Salem today?
I did.
All right. And so, Maria, I was hoping you could tell us about your brother Chase and what your family went through after that day in 2012.
Sure. Thank you again for having me. And, you know, I'm just one voice, unfortunately, hundreds of voices and families and victims that should be shared and remembered. So again, I'm just here to speak about, you know, my brother and his story and kind of what led up to that night. He and I both grew up in Salem. We're both adopted. Our parents split up when he was barely a year old. I was about five or so. So we grew up in different, different homes, split homes. Chase was just, unanimously a very quiet and gentle soul. He had a very winning smile and was just loved by so many. He had so many friends and community members that would support him in his journey. Chase grew up, you know, pretty average, you know, childhood, but always struggled a little bit, whether that was in the classroom or with mental health stuff. And Chase soon struggled with addiction very early on as a young teenager. And to kind of, you know, fast forward, there's just so much I could say really about him and his life and what he's left us. You know, he had been struggling with addiction, struggling with mental health leading up to that, the day in 2012. Part of my, you know, story and what I'm trying to find my voice is that, you know, the mental health component and the one more day, you know, he had kind of a series of very unfortunate events go on because of our adoption. Our citizenship was in question. We had just recently found out that we were permanent residents and not full citizens. And so losing his ID was really big for him that weekend, as anybody that struggles with that barrier. He lost his ID, lost his wallet, lost his phone, and he had relapsed that weekend. And it was just a very trying weekend. And I was, you know, trying to bring it back. And he had actually just come out of treatment in June. He was bound and determined to make it back. He has two daughters that he left, and his oldest daughter, her birthday is the 22nd, and he wanted to be back for her birthday in July. It was really important for him to be back. So he'd come back, and maybe a little bit too soon, but was still, you know, working his steps and going to his meeting and going to outpatient and really trying to live a sober life. And all of these things had happened over this weekend, and I was telling him, you know, you just hold on. Like, we're going to find your phone. We're going to find your wallet. It's going to be okay. I promise. Well, you know, like, well, I'll look at, you know, make account. I'll get you a new phone on Monday. Like, it, you know, it was going to be okay. He just kind of downward spiraled. And Sunday night, He met up with his oldest daughter's mom, and they had this kind of unique bond. They were both teen parents. They had their daughter when they were 16 and 17-ish. So they'd grown up together, and they had this unique bond where they would rely on each other when times were getting rough. And she went over to the house and kind of talked him down and promised that he wouldn't hurt himself. And she went away, and then she got a phone call. Somebody came back. And he was gone. So this is all taking place at my father's home that night. My dad didn't want to worry me, and I was at a basketball game for my oldest son. My phone had died. I was unreachable. He couldn't have called me if he wanted to. She couldn't get a hold of me. And it just kind of went very south very quick in a hurry. My father came back over. They were looking for him, couldn't find him. And I had a gut feeling that something was very, very wrong, that something was not, this wasn't going to turn out well. I didn't think it was going to turn out the way it did. I thought they were going to come and help. I was naive. I did. I thought that they were going to, when I found out the police had been called, I did. I thought that they were going to come and help, that there was, you know, we were going to be able to de-escalate the situation, that we were going to be able to find or locate him and get him to where he needed to be so that he could get the help that he needed that night. We all ended up at my father's house. There was already a perimeter formed on one side of the street. The other side of the street kind of wraps down, and there's a hill over here. And Commercial is a main drag in Salem. My father's house sits right about two blocks up from that main street. The police had formed this, you know, perimeter, and they didn't really know what to do. There was very clear early on there was absolutely no plan. The lieutenant that was there really didn't have a plan. The officers were just kind of standing around next to their cars. You know, it's, in my opinion, in Salem, you know, very often you'll see a car pulled over and there's two and three police cars. And nothing's going on, but there's a lot of police activity, and it's very, very common, and it's been that way my whole life growing up there. And so, you know, I started asking the questions. I want to know why. Like, what are you doing? What is the plan? Where is he? Why don't you have people looking for him? I was like, maybe he could be at the cemetery. Our grandparents are buried very close by. That's a very sacred place for him. Maybe he's there. There's a park right down the road. Have you looked at the park? Have you been down to Commercial? Have you been here? Have you been there? Have you called this person? No, well, they just didn't have any answers. They also didn't know if he was in the house or not. You know, we had knocked on the windows. Knocked on the door, no response. Didn't know if he was there or not. They wouldn't allow me to go in to the house. I begged for them to let me go in the house because I knew that even if he was there with any sort of weapon, that I knew that he wouldn't hurt me. Again, because the threat was to hurt himself. He had a nonviolent history. He wasn't there to hurt anybody else. Some time passed, which, you know, feels like forever, but now in retrospect, it wasn't. My niece's mom, myself, and my father were all present during this whole thing. My brother came up the crest of the hill. He was under the influence of some intoxicants. I have a side to my story, and the police have testified to the side of their story, that he had a firearm in his hand. It was, according to their testimony, he was holding it by the butt upside down. And my niece's mom said, "I think that's Chase." And I looked up, and he loved the Oregon Ducks. He had a bright green, brand new Oregon Duck sweatshirt on. I yelled his name. He kind of looked over, looked very, very out of sorts. He also had a physical impairment. He was limping. And within a blink of an eye, they were yelling. He had absolutely no chance to respond to any commands. It was simultaneous yelling and shooting all at the same time. I had ran towards him when the shooting started, immediately grabbed my niece's mom, and we took cover behind her car until the shooting stopped. I looked up through the car windows and saw my brother laying on the ground on wet pavement. That's the last memory I have of him.
And Maria, you were separated, all of you, by the officers afterwards, you told me, right?
Yeah, correct. Not only before we were separated, it was pretty apparent what had happened. I mean, there had been a shooting. Of course, naively, I thought they couldn't kill him. I remember my dad was standing there, and he had his hands over his face, and he said, "Why did they do that? Why did they do that? Why did they do that?" And he just kept repeating that. "Why did they do that? Why did they do that?" Because it was so non-threatening. He was walking up the hill. He was walking up the hill. I just remember, like, screaming, like, "He's walking up the hill. Like, what are you doing? What are you doing?" And they wouldn't let me go to him. And nobody ever notified us on scene that he was deceased. The way that I had reality hit me very quickly was that the ambulance that was on scene drove away with no lights. There was no chaplain. There was no police officer in charge. There was no chief that came up to us and announced that what had happened. That was my reality. And my niece's mom was, you know, screaming, "He can't be dead." And I you know, it's like you have somehow, some way, your brain functions where you kind of pull it together for a moment in time. And it was like, "No, he's gone." I remember yelling, "He's gone, he's gone, he's gone. Don't look, don't look, don't look." Immediately afterwards, they took us by way of a police car, making you feel like you have absolutely no rights in this situation. Mm-hmm. Like you just didn't witness the murdering of your loved one. They make you feel completely powerless. They took my father, myself, and my niece's mother to down to the Salem Police Department, and it just kept getting later and later. They had us in a conference room and separated us, all three of us, pulled us all apart, took our cell phones away. I was escorted to and from the bathroom. They wouldn't let us talk to each other, even in the room. They kept telling us to be quiet, don't talk to each other. I remember when my niece's mom was taken away, I just remember screaming at her, like, "You know what happened, you know what happened, like, stick, you know, like, be strong, stick to your story." Again, not knowing my rights, I didn't know what power I had in that situation. When I was questioned by a Salem police officer, and I believe a Kaiser police officer, because, you know, they help with the investigation. They're investigating each other at that point in time. I stuck to my guns. I'm like, they're not, I pulled it together. I mean, I went from hysteria to I need to get through this moment in time. And during the questioning, sat and listened to it with Ashley and the audio, and we laughed. You know, it was humorous because I wasn't going to let them get me. I knew what they were doing. I knew what they were doing. I knew that they wanted me to give in to their questioning and to give them their outs. You know, I remember them wanting to draw. They wanted me to draw things. They wanted me to write things, and And I would shut them down, and I would sit in their silence. I wasn't going to play their games. And it was very apparent listening to the audio, and it was kind of a proud moment when I got to listen to the audio a couple of years afterwards, because I, at that moment in time, I knew exactly what I needed to do. That was a Sunday. I think by Tuesday or Wednesday, we were sitting with Ashley Albies, and they so graciously, Ashley and Michael, took our case and worked with us until 2016. It was, you know, very long and emotional road of you know, drafts and court proceedings and emotional repair and recovery. You know, we did come to a settlement September of 2016 with the city of Salem after four federal, you know, we had two in-person meetings with Judge Acosta, two over the phone, to come to this decision that sits right here. My nieces were awarded some money. And
Maria, we'd like to keep talking about that after the break here, especially about your settlement and about some of the issues you mentioned with the follow-up after the incident. And I'm sure that we've got a lot to talk about on those notes in the next segment. Yeah. All right, and we're back. So we heard from Maria Hammer on the last on the last segment. And I'd like to continue that conversation with everybody here. And one thing that we were talking about over the break is some of the striking commonalities between your story, Maria, especially the treatment that you received from the officers after after the shooting, immediately after, and commonalities between that and other incidents. I mean, for example, in 2012 alone, 12 people in Oregon were shot and killed by police, and many, many more were shot at or wounded. And it's that your story, as you mentioned, that's the first time that you're telling that
it
publicly.
Is. Mm-hmm.
And that there are, it's not the only one.
No.
I'd like to open it up. If anybody would like to chime in, Kalei, you were mentioning
the Glenn family of Washington County their case, which was so similar in details, because a young man was feeling very badly. He imbibed something or other. His family were concerned. They called the police, thinking the police would help. Rather than help, they shot the young man. The family fortunately had a good attorney, took the case, and they ended up winning the case. Part of the winning of the case had to do with the fact that the police officers lied. They were caught lying, and because of those lies that they told, the Glenn family won their case. And that case, Glenn versus Washington County, has become part of the findings in the city of Portland. So every family that struggles through these difficult times towards some kind of a victory for justice, for equity, for balance, does a noble act. And I thank you very much, Maria.
And we thank you for everybody here that's doing what they're doing too. You guys came before, you know, my family and whatnot. And I just wanted to circle back to the point that you made about there was no crime. You know, my brother hadn't. That wasn't why they were called. They weren't called because he was committing a crime, in the neighborhood or domestic violence or anything like that. You know, there was exactly what you said it so well. There was no crime. There's no crime being committed. There should be no reason to use that type of force with somebody at all. There's zero excuse. I also want to mention that soon after, when my brother was killed, the officer Ryan Demmer was actually awarded a Medal of Valor. Mm. For killing my brother.
For that incident.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because he was the Independent Police Association that gave him that medal awarded him for keeping the civilians safe that night.
And he was promoted to sergeant.
Yes, he was also promoted. There was a cadet on scene that was out of place and shouldn't have been. Officer Livingston shouldn't have been where he was during the call. He was also, he's now a full-time Salem police officer as well. Mm. Had no bearing on his hiring. His permanent hiring.
Dan, you're talking a little bit about the way that in those interviews that the police do after incidents, like after shooting somebody, the way that they steer people away from seeking representation for themselves.
Well, certainly we have a culture where a lot of people watch television and where they think that if they're arrested that the police are going to tell them that what their rights are, because that's what you see on TV. But in truth, that those rights, which are called the Miranda rights based on a Supreme Court case that said you have to be told them before you're interrogated, says that just that. They don't have to tell you your rights until they're about to ask you questions. So people need to know their rights. They need to know that they have the right to remain silent. And they need to know they have the right to an attorney. And those are the two rights that everybody hears they say on TV all the time. And I'm very glad, and during the break, Maria said that she had not got training on that when she refused to tell the police anything about what happened, which is exactly what the right thing to do. You know, wait and say, I want to talk to my lawyer, and do not talk to the police. That's the most basic thing that I could suggest to people. Now, everybody's going to have a different circumstance, and there's going to be circumstances where if you are vulnerable and if the police are threatening you, you might end up needing to cooperate with them and then, you know, double back later and file a lawsuit or a claim or a complaint, depending on what they do, because they will sometimes accuse you of failing the attitude test. They don't use that term, but that's what they do. And they'll arrest people for asserting their rights. So sometimes people have to be very cautious about asserting those rights. But that's what your rights are supposed to be. You know, you said that before. You know, what your rights are and what they're supposed to be are not always the same thing. But essentially, I wish to remain silent and I want to talk to a lawyer are the two magic phrases that you should remember when you're being asked by the police.
Yeah. And Teresa, you handed us these fantastic cards from the ACLU, or these little pocket-sized brochures, the Know Your Rights things. And we had a question from a caller actually on this topic, and just asking, like, what are your actual rights when interacting with the police?
Yeah, well, you have the right to remain silent. You don't have to show them ID. You don't have to tell them who you are. You can ask for an attorney at any time. And if you feel like they're holding you in a place, you can ask them, am I free to leave? Am I being detained? And if they're not detaining you, and I think that by using their language, that you can wake them up if they're in the middle of intimidating or harassing you. I'm thinking sometimes that if you start asserting your rights like a robot, am I being arrested? Am I being detained? That maybe they'll say, oh, this person knows their rights. And do I actually have a warrant for their arrest? Is there any reason that I'm in contact with them? And maybe they'll second think and let you go. You also have the right to say that I don't consent to searches, which means that if the police officers say that they want to look in your bag or they want to look in your pockets or can you let me check your car or anything like that, you do have the right to say that I don't consent to searches. And you should say that. Now, that's not going to stop them from searching you, but it will give your attorney an opportunity to defend you when you take it to court. So let's say that you say, I don't want to answer any questions, and the officer doesn't let you leave. Let's say that you say, am I being detained? And they don't answer your question, but they still don't allow you to leave. You don't have to get disruptive at that point. You have to think about your own personal safety. And if you feel like speaking out could be a threat to your safety, just be quiet, stay calm, and deal with the process. If they put the handcuffs on you, continue to assert your rights until you are safely in a police station where they have to actually book you. Because at that point, you know that now you're in, you know, in this space, and they have on the record that you've been arrested and you're not with the officer that arrested you, and you will get an opportunity to contact an attorney. And this is a very serious, scary situation. But even if they come to your house to report to you that your child has been murdered, use that same opportunity to assert your rights and to not speak to them. Because as Maria was saying, and as Dan was saying, in my advocacy, the majority of the families that I deal with, they don't know that once their child is taken away, that the violation of that person's civil liberties are still being to the deflection. They're still being to the detriment of them getting justice. The questions that they ask the families as they're sitting there dealing with this this announcement, it's still an opportunity to assert your rights. So always assert your rights. If you don't have an attorney, never speak to the law enforcement. Period.
And to kind of piggyback on that, you know, when we were at the police station, we were still not even told that he was deceased. Mm-hmm. And they, in their line of questioning,
they were there
to help us, but yet anything that they were trying to assert had nothing to do with helping myself, my niece's mother, or my father. It had everything to do with helping them. That's what their line of questioning was, and I cannot stress that enough. You know, in retrospect, I guess it was my gut instinct had shut me down, and I know that my niece's mom had asked for a lawyer. She kept repeating mm-hmm. herself. Why am I here? Why can't I leave? I want to speak to a lawyer. I want my father. Yeah. Like she wasn't a minor, but she was, you know, a young woman. She was asking those questions too. And, you know, I just telling her to stay strong going into that, because I didn't know what was going to happen as soon as we were in those rooms.
Okay. So this is an intense conversation, and I think this is a good place to take a pause. When we come back, we will be talking about what we can do. And we are back for the closing segment of our panel discussion on the state of policing in Portland. We are here with Dan Handelman, Maria Hammer, Teresa Rayford, and Ted and Kelly Lubin. Sam is here with me, and I'm Jasmine. This has been a sort of a broad and ranging conversation, as it must be in a situation like this. And we've just spent the last couple of segments talking about kind of the worst case scenario, when someone that has incredible value to us is taken away due to police violence. And that is something that, when you hear those stories, they really have an impact on you, and they really do represent the worst, the worst that we can imagine. But the police violence also has a whole other range of impacts in our communities, from stifling protest to making people feel unsafe and harassed, to any number of other things. When you have a violent, aggressive force in your community that's not being checked, that's not being held accountable, it's very difficult to feel safe and productive and happy. And so for this last section, what we'd like to talk about is how you can get involved, the efforts that are being made to change the way things are done in Portland. And I mean, it's not just in Portland. These efforts are nationwide, because everybody recognizes that there's a problem with the way police are treating people in the United States at the large and small scale. But so what's being done in our community? How can our listeners get involved? And what can everybody do today to change something? Does anybody feel like they can jump in?
Don't kill yourself.
Well, that's a tall order, but here's the thing. There, I was actually out cop watching before. That's why I was a little late today. We were downtown walking around, and we talked to a lot of homeless people in Old Town Chinatown, and most of them said the police were actually treating them nicely, which is refreshing to hear. I mean, I've been doing Portland Cop Watch since we started 25 years ago, and there's lots of bad horror stories about what the police do, especially to homeless people, and people of color and other vulnerable people. But the two people that we interviewed had complaints about our oversight system, the Independent Police Review, and to me, that's never happened before. It's like, so we have, in addition to readjusting, let's say, the police and their directives and their policies and their training and their hiring practices, we also have to look at our oversight system. That's we haven't really even touched on. I talked about the old system that was called PIAC. In 2000, I sat on a mayor's work task force that helped try to reinvent what was a very flawed system back then. What happened was that PIAC could make recommendations to city council, and city council could make recommendations to the chief, and the chief could say, no, thank you. So they three times told the chief of police, we want to sustain a finding of misconduct, and the chief said, thanks for your recommendation, but I don't have to do that. And these are our elected officials, right, making these decisions. So they changed the system so that now there's a citizen body called the Citizen Review Committee that you can appeal your cases to, and if the Bureau refuses to adopt a finding that they propose, it goes to City Council, and City Council has the final say. There's only been two hearings like that in the entire 16 years since we've had this system in place. Okay. And the most recent one, the City Council did not try to sustain the complaint. They came up with what's called a not sustained finding, which means insufficient evidence. So what I'm getting at is that people should get involved in looking at this oversight system and trying to help strengthen it. It's an ongoing process that we've been whittling away little by little to make the system a little bit more like the one that we envisioned in the year 2000 and even before that when we started Cop Watch. And the next meeting of the Citizen Review Committee is this coming Wednesday at 5:30 p.m. There's a case of a cop watcher, not somebody from our group, somebody who was watching the police, who was threatened with arrest because he was using his video camera, and the police officer said that it was illegal, which is not true. Oregon law actually has changed in favor of cop watchers. Mm-hmm. So people can go down to City Hall Wednesday at 5:30. Then on Thursday, Clay, do you want to give the details on the AMA coalition?
The AMA Coalition for Justice and Police Reform will be holding a membership meeting at 4222 Northeast 13th, or enter on 13th, at 5 o'clock. Anybody that would like to show up should feel free to show up. But in addition to that, I'm starting to work on creating a curriculum for citizen education. And so if you stay tuned with Cop Watch or the AMA Coalition, and maybe even KBOO, maybe even Teresa, maybe we can get together a little bit of a program similar to this, mm-hmm. but maybe a little bit more structured in the sense of what every citizen in Portland needs to know is that your own citizens who have been very active, including academia, we have done a lot of research. We know a lot. We know what the cures are. But the political will is lacking, and the power of the Portland Police Association is overwhelming. So if we citizens would get together, you know, united, we might be able to make the changes that would improve our history. So that would be my 2 cents. Get involved wherever you are. Almost every single church has a peace or justice or social concerns committee. Join it. Start asking questions. One thing will lead to another. But right now, you can get on your computer and look up Black and Blue. That is a wonderful history of the abuses suffered by the Black community in Portland. And I owe that Black community a debt of gratitude because the civil rights work done by Black people benefits all of us. So thank you very much, Teresa.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm from that community, and I know the leaders that built a lot of that value, because they built that value in me as a child that grew up in that neighborhood and against all of these odds. And so some of the work that we're doing right now is in relativity to some of the things we talked about. Kalia was talking about the racism here in Portland, and so we've been doing bystander intervention workshops and dialogues, not only to communities that are very privileged and might not have seen as much racism and want to disenfranchise the people that are creating violence around it, but also with communities of color. And we've been doing that over at the Artist Repertory Theater and other various places throughout the city with amazing groups, the World Affairs Council and all these different private organizations that really want to understand structurally how they can intervene in some of these issues with policy that allows the discrimination to be so rampant, because we are utilizing our policing force as an authority and as an effective enforcement tool against people. When we look at it in the school systems, we're seeing that reports are being written about children where someone's saying they need to be referred to CSD or Department of Human Services and different things like this, but then the outcomes are the disadvantage with the overrepresentation in our foster care system and the overrepresentation of those same parents in our adult jail systems for very minor infractions. And so we have to delegitimize that enforcement tool by educating community and showing people that from whatever position they're in, they have the power to intervene and influence policy that will work for all of us. And when we talk about influencing policy, I've been going back and forth to Salem since 2010 after the murder of my nephew. And I've also taken my voice to Senate Judiciary Committees in Washington, D.C., where I got to meet with Michelle Obama in regards to gun violence. And again, bringing those messages back to the general public in my neighborhood, because for whatever reason, there's resistance from the status quo. There's resistance from leaders that could basically appropriate safety measures to make sure that we're all included in all these things that we need to be included in. I hear Dan and I hear Kalia saying that we should continue to go to these meetings and we should continue to try to function so that we have a seat at the table. But it's very hard to do that as a person of color in this city. If you're not already vetted and you're not the approved people that they want at the table, they will use violence. They will use the media to discredit you, to take away your voice and your priorities, and to manufacture whatever they can use to kind of make it hard for you to get this voice out. And so I want to commend everybody that's here, and especially Maria, because the families are the ones that we're here for. I'm a victim survivor of gun violence that happened in my community and in my family, and I don't like it. I don't think that there's any answers, but I do believe that building community as a priority, to knowing your neighbors as a priority, we have to do that during this Trump administration, because his making America great again means that he's going to have an America that does not include us. And we should not stand for that.
Yeah. I just have to say that, you know, I wouldn't be here today if I wouldn't have made the connection to the Pacific Northwest Family Circle. And so just on their behalf, you know, they are, you know, comprised of some amazing, strong women and some great families. And I just, you know, invite you to connect with them on Facebook or connect with them via email. Let me see if I can pull that up. It's PNW Family Circle @gmail.com, and they're just here for support and to connect to resources, and I just can't thank them enough for, you know, having such welcoming arms to me.
And I'd just like to add on that note quick, also coming up on the 12th of this month is the monthly vigil for Keaton Otis at Northeast 6th and Halsey in Portland, and that is semi run by Pacific Northwest Family Circle, but it continued after that shooting with his father, Fred Bryant, and after Fred Bryant's passing, it has continued with some other community members as well.
I just wanted to also say, when you mentioned President Trump, I'm reminded we started a campaign actually 9 months ago, but we launched it for real a few weeks ago to get Portland out of the Joint Terrorism Task Force, which is another way they're trying to oppress our communities by having working with the FBI. So if you go to portlandcopwatch.org/pjttf.html or to our front homepage, portlandcopwatch.org, you can see more information about that campaign.
Okay, thank you, Dan, and thank you to all of our guests. To summarize, get involved in police oversight. Go to a CRC meeting. Get involved in the AMA's work. Go to that. Go to their meeting on the 7th at 5 p.m. Get involved in strengthening your communities. Build our communities, make them stronger, make sure that we have a bond that's stronger than attempts to break it down, and support families and their work in supporting each other. So thank you again for everybody for being here. It has been a real pleasure to talk with all of you. Calais, Ted, Teresa, Maria, Dan, and thank you, Sam.